You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and April of this year marks the 10-year anniversary of this show. I started in 2014 on KBUR-AM in Burlington and continued on WVIK starting in September 2020. You know, people always ask my favorite shows over the years, and my guest today ranks right at the top of my list. He isn't a president or former president or any kind of politician that I've interviewed. He's actually an author, and he's back today to be my guest, and I'm very, very happy to have him here. I'd have to say one of my favorite shows was interviewing my guest, James Kaplan, on his definitive biography of Frank Sinatra. The chairman of the board's life had an enormous impact on American culture, and James shared some very fascinating stories of Frank's involvement in American politics. Well, James has written another masterpiece. It just came out, and it's called Three Shades of Blue: Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Bill Evans, and the Lost Empire of Cool. If you like music, especially that quintessential American music, jazz, if you like history, culture, a little bit of politics, race relations, and just some inside look at the music business in the 1950s, 1940s, you're going to love this show, and I think my listeners will enjoy this. James, thank you so much for taking the time.
Robin, it's a great pleasure and an honor to be here with you again. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess we get started. I mean, I want to ask you how you came to write this book, which is very—it's hilarious at the end of the book. But set the stage for us here. I guess the background, the musical landscape of this period, and kind of what led these three very unique and talented musicians together.
Right. Well, I guess I begin my part of the story with an assignment, a very lucky assignment from Vanity Fair back in 1989. My late brother, Peter Kaplan, a great newspaper editor in New York City, was talking to an editor he knew at Vanity Fair, and the editor said that Vanity Fair was about to publish Miles Davis's memoir, and they needed a writer to do a profile of Miles to go along to go into the magazine along with the an excerpt from Miles's memoir, and they were looking for a writer who knew jazz. And my wonderful brother told this editor at Vanity Fair that his brother James knew absolutely everything there was to know about jazz. This was very far from the truth, and it's very nice of my brother. But at that point, I owned maybe five or six jazz albums out of 200 LPs, and beginning to collect CDs. And but somehow landed the assignment and found myself taking the elevator up to the 14th floor of the Essex House, a residential hotel in Central Park South in New York City, to meet Miles Davis, and my knees were knocking because Miles Davis's reputation had preceded him. He was the Prince of Darkness. He did not suffer fools lightly. He turned his back on audiences. He had a temper. He could glower. He was a great artist. So I was really scared. And the door opened to his suite, and there was this tiny man, shirtless, wearing balloony black pajama pants and little Alibaba slippers with the toes curled up. And he was wearing also this giant wig of brown curls. And he had a atomizer in his hand. He kept on spritzing water on it. I walked in and expecting to be flayed alive by Miles Davis, but instead he was kind. He was kind and welcoming, and he answered my very ignorant questions to the best of his ability. I went to that meeting with his publicist. The publicist told me I had 1 hour period with Miles. That was it. But at the end, I knew I didn't have nearly enough to base a piece on, because my questions were so ignorant, I asked if I could come back, and he said yes. So I had the great privilege of being able to interview the great Miles Davis. And when I flash forward about 30 years, talking with my editor at Penguin Press, Scott Moyers, about what book I might do next, he had an idea of a book about Kind of Blue, the best-selling and arguably best-loved jazz album of all time. And I suddenly remembered that I had done this interview with Miles years before, and I had all the transcript still. And I said back to Scott, well, that sounds fascinating, but what about a book about who the three musicians I consider the three geniuses of that album? And that's Miles, John Coltrane, and Bill Evans. And my editor, Scott Moyer, said sold, and I was off to the races. These were three musicians who all played together really only for a very brief time. And after the six musicians, and there were three other very fine musicians, two of them arguably great, Cannonball Adderley and the bassist Paul Chambers, Cannonball Adderley, alto saxophonist, and a very fine drummer as well, Jimmy Cobb. But the three geniuses of that album were really Miles and Coltrane and Evans. And after they recorded that album, after the second recording session, April of 1959, they never played together again, all six of them. So I wanted to capture these musicians as men and musicians up to and then during and then after the making of Kind of Blue. But the album itself, which is so great, it's so great, and it really holds up as few albums do, I think. And it's really timeless, as few albums are, I think. They managed to make this genius work of art, and it sort of exploded like a supernova or a nebula, you know, and then they all went their separate ways. Miles to keep on leading other bands, Coltrane to lead his own bands, and Evans to play in the trio format for the rest of his short career. He died at age 51 in 1980. But all three fascinating guys, fascinating careers, and all three very flawed and damaged men, especially when it came to the demon drug heroin. And I don't say that lightly. It really was a demon, and a demon unleashed by the great Charlie Parker, Byrd.
I'll ask about that. I want to ask about that at some point here, but what was interesting to me was you give kind of a musical history here, which I'm not a musician, but I love listening to music and studying it. And you talked about how jazz had changed that really enabled this flourishing of artists like the three people in this book, and how it changed from more, I guess, scripted, I don't know if that's the word, to more improvisation. Can you kind of share that a little bit with our audience to give them a flavor?
Yeah, well, jazz between the two world wars in this country, jazz being America's only really homegrown art and a great art and invented by Black people, but very quickly joined by a number of white people, some of whom became outstanding players. Jazz from its inception until the middle to end of World War II was dance music. And in the 1930s and early 40s, you had the swing era, and you had these great big bands with Jimmy Lunsford and Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey and Duke Ellington. But the war really destroyed the big bands in several different ways. First of all, a lot of the musicians got drafted. Second of all, there were all kinds of shortages during World War II, especially gasoline. You weren't supposed to drive unless it was absolutely necessary. So the big bands had trouble getting around, since a lot of them traveled by bus. The big bands kind of imploded and became smaller and smaller and more economically viable groups. And then, right smack in the middle of World War II, you had a number of young Black geniuses, but in particular Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, creating this brand new kind of jazz called bebop that was very complicated, very fast, lots of chords, and really in a certain way designed for by musicians, this futuristic new kind of jazz for almost for other musicians. But at that moment, the moment bebop came alive, jazz really ceased to be a dance music and became instead a listening music. And what you had from the end of World War II until year 1955, really, it was the year that Charlie Parker died, that was really the end of bebop, was bebop. And then a reaction to bebop, which was a new, more soulful, more melodious kind of jazz, still largely listening music, not dance music. They called it hard bop. It wasn't hard. It wasn't bop, but that's what they called it anyway. Great exponents like Art Blakey and Horace Silver playing this wonderful new, very catchy form of jazz. And this progressed through the 1950s until Miles Davis, who had played hard bop and played very soulfully throughout that decade, decided he wanted a change. He wanted a more simple kind of jazz and fewer chords and something that sounded completely different. And he had very specific ideas about what he wanted to do in the album that became Kind of Blue.
What you describe Kind of Blue, it kind of a hinge point in the growth of jazz and then decline of jazz. But I guess answer that, James, and then also what made Kind of Blue so unique? So, I mean, where people were still listening to it to this day.
Yeah. 1959 was really a hinge year in jazz. You had four tremendous events. You had Kind of Blue. You had the album Mingus Ah Om by the great bassist Charles Mingus. You had the great record Time Out by Dave Brubeck with the classic deathless tune Take Five. And then you had this very strange new form of jazz. A lot of people called it free jazz, brought in by a great saxophonist named Ornette Coleman. So it was a really crucial year, a very productive year for jazz, but it was also a year when things kind of bounced off in a strange direction. And free jazz, so-called, that Ornette Coleman was the great exponent of, really took jazz off in this new direction that became very fascinating to jazz musicians and less fascinating to the general public, harder to understand to the general public. But going back to Miles for a second, Miles had two ideas for this new album he wanted to do in 1959. He had seen Les Ballets Africains, African Ballet Company, and he had fallen in love with the rhythms and the dance and the music of this very complicated polyrhythms, but less complicated music. A lot of it played on the African finger piano, kalimba. And so he wanted to simplify his own music, and he also was thinking about his days visiting his grandparents in Arkansas. They had a farm in Arkansas when he was a boy. Miles used to walk home late at night sometimes along a country road, and he remembered hearing the ghostly voices of Black gospel singers in a nearby church. He wanted to somehow get that African, simplified African music, complicated rhythms. He wanted to get that gospel, the ghostly gospel singing into this album. And he wanted to use, and I hope I'm not being too musically esoteric because I'm not really a musician either. I have a decent ear, but he wanted to put fewer chords into his music. Jazz to that point had been largely based on the blues, or it had been based, a lot of jazz tunes were based on American songbook standards, All the Things You Are or Love for Sale, great tunes like that. And then there were so many creative jazz musicians in the 40s and 50s who wrote their own jazz tunes, but with a lot of chords. And Miles had this fascination with what are called modes, there's nothing esoteric about that. A mode is just a kind of scale, musical scale. So, for example, if you hear a certain piece of music, and you can suddenly say to yourself, "Oh, that sounds like Asian music or Chinese music," or "Oh, that sounds like Middle Eastern music." That is a particular kind of scale, and Miles wanted to use new kinds of scales, but fewer chords, and the two things I told you about, and he also had met this piano player named Bill Evans. Bill Evans could have been a great classical pianist, but he fell in love with jazz as a teenager, and he made himself the fastest boogie-woogie player in New Jersey. Classical still wasn't out of his soul, and so he went to college, studied classical, but kept playing jazz. And then in 1955, Bill Evans came to New York City with the goal of making it in jazz or going home. And he played a lot of weddings and dances and bar mitzvahs, and he snagged a job at the Village Vanguard, great jazz club in Greenwich Village, playing in between the sets of what was then. And I would ask your listeners to remember or even imagine that in the 1950s, jazz was very big in this country. There were a lot of local newspapers. There were a lot of music columnists. People wrote about jazz. A lot of people, most Americans, knew who Duke Ellington was, who Ella Fitzgerald was, who Miles Davis was. And a lot of jazz fans knew who the Modern Jazz Quartet were. And the Modern Jazz Quartet, they were very distinguished for very distinguished looking young black men who wore dark suits and ties, and they played a very sedate, quiet brand of jazz. And when during their sets at the Village Vanguard, the place would go dead silent, respectful silence as the Modern Jazz Quartet played. Anyway, Bill Evans snagged this job playing in between their sets. And whenever the Modern Jazz Quartet took a break, Bill Evans would start to play and the people would start to drink and eat and clash silverware and dishes and talk to each other loudly. Anyway, Bill Evans wasn't making much headway into his 2-year plan to succeed in jazz. Until one night he looked down at the end of the grand piano he was playing at the Village Vanguard, and there are the eyes of Miles Davis staring at him. And a week later, Miles calls him up, and Miles says to Bill Evans, "Join my band." And when Miles Davis said, "Join my band," you joined his band. Miles was fascinated with Evans, with his classical training, with the sounds of Ravel and Kachaturian and Stravinsky and Mussorgsky and Bartok that Bill Evans could bring into jazz piano playing in a way that no other pianist really could bring. And Miles was listening to a lot of those composers himself. And so after Evans joined his band, they began playing this new kind of jazz, simpler, with these new fascinating harmonies that Evans brought along. And that was the third leg of the tripod of Kind of Blue. Miles said afterwards that he really designed that album around the piano playing of Bill Evans.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is author James Kaplan, who finished a book that just came out called Three Shades of Blue, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Bill Evans, and the Lost Empire of Cool. He's been talking about that book a little bit here, and boy, I just can't emphasize to my listeners enough that you'll just love this book. It's written about, as James described, the events leading up to and after the recording of the most iconic jazz album, Kind of Blue. And it was kind of an eerie coincidence I got to share with my listeners here, because I was listening to a CD of Tony Bennett and Bill Evans in the morning. And then later in the evening, I looked up at my bookshelf and I saw the Sinatra biographies you've written. And it struck me. I thought, I wonder what James is up to. I haven't seen he's written anything. I go to your website, I Google, and there's this book. And here we are. It's just an outstanding book, and so many angles, and the historical part I really like. I'm also curious too. These are three distinct individuals. You've talked about Evans and Davis, and then John Coltrane. Talk a little bit about their background, and especially the little bit of racial pushback here involving Bill Evans being a part of this.
Sure. Well, they all had fascinating backgrounds. Miles Davis came out of the Midwest. St. Louis. And unusually in that time, he came from a very prosperous family. His father was a successful dentist in St. Louis. And Miles, as a young man, as a boy and a young man, was a kind of young prince. He dressed very well. He rode horses on his father's farm. And then he played trumpet, and he played it really well. And he managed to encounter Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker when they played one time in St. Louis. And they said to him, they liked his playing. They said, well, next time you're in New York, look us up. So Miles convinces his father, Miles Davis himself was Miles III. Miles convinces his father, the dentist, to send him to New York City to Juilliard. And Miles goes to Juilliard, the great musical school in New York City, and very quickly loses interest in the curriculum there, but very quickly connects with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and starts to, lo and behold, to the astonishment of everybody, Charlie Parker hires Miles Davis to play in his band. Bill Evans, I talked about a little bit, and made his goal in 1955 and got hired by Miles Davis. Let me get back to that in a second and talk for a moment about John Coltrane, who was a musical genius, and he was a brilliant and incredibly hardworking saxophone player who practiced 16 hours a day, literally. If he would practice that horn until his fingers bled, and if anybody complained about the noise late at night, he would practice his fingering on the saxophone. So he was not only hardworking, not only brilliant, but he was a deeply shy man, and he was expert at in a way that Miles Davis was not, and certainly Frank Sinatra never was. John Coltrane was expert at hiding his light under a bushel, and so for the first 10 years or so of his jazz career, he played R&B. He played with a lot of R&B bands all around the country. You could at times find John Coltrane walking the bar in some saloon down south. You would walk in and he'd literally be walking along the bar playing his horn. He was very embarrassed by having to do that, but that was showbiz and that was part of the gig. And in 1955, Miles hires John Coltrane to be in his band to the amazement of the music community, because nobody knew who Coltrane was. He had hid his light. But as Miles once said, Coltrane was the loudest, fastest saxophone player he had ever heard. A lot of that was developed while Coltrane was playing R&B. And besides the volume and the speed, Miles quickly saw he was possessed of genius, and that's why he hired him. And even though nobody got it at first, people came to see why Miles had hired Coltrane. Unfortunately, Coltrane was also a drug addict when Miles hired him, and within a couple of years, Miles also had to fire him. But then Coltrane cleaned up, and Miles hired him back again.
That's something you alluded to earlier that I wanted to mention. One chapter in the book, you intersperse the text with the births and deaths of quite a few jazz pioneers. And Charlie Parker, for example, died at 34. 34. And all three of these individuals, the protagonists of this book, struggled with substance abuse. Did they feel that they needed to have some alteration to stimulate better play, or was this just kind of given at that time among folks in music?
Well, the first thing was there was this Pandora's box named Charlie Yardbird Parker. Charlie Parker was the greatest alto saxophone player ever to hit the planet. He was also a monumental heroin addict from a very early age. And this horrible myth arose because Charlie Parker, because Bird could play so incredibly well, so fast and so beautifully, even when he was high on heroin, this myth arose that if you want to play like Bird, you have to do like Bird. And so the myth became that if you put heroin into your veins with a needle, that it would enable you to play as brilliantly as Charlie Parker. And of course, that was a complete myth. But so many young jazz musicians succumbed to the poison of heroin, and so many of them died very young. A few of them survived. Miles managed to kick. The great Sonny Rollins, who I was so fortunate to interview for my book, was a heroin addict, but then in the mid-50s committed himself to the Federal Correctional Institution in Lexington, Kentucky, where they did detox, and he cleansed himself of heroin there. But it was a plague. It was a plague that blew through jazz and killed dozens and dozens of promising young artists. It was a horrible thing. But I also want to say this, and it's I want you to understand that I am in no way even beginning to endorse the use of hard drugs. In any way, heroin long ago fell out of fashion in jazz. But Sonny Rollins told me that there was another aspect to heroin, as far as he and his Black colleagues in jazz were concerned. He told me that despite the fact that he had been hit hard by heroin, that he had to go and detox it in Lexington, Kentucky, in spite of all that, Sonny Rollins said that heroin was our form, meaning Black musicians' form of rebellion against white society in the 1950s. And so it was complicated. And there were musicians, and I talked to musicians who told me that they felt they really could play in a different way and maybe even a better way while they were on heroin. But there's no way of justifying this drug that can kill you in an instant and that killed so many. And everybody who survived kicked the drug.
James, I wanted to ask, we're not going to be able to cover everything here, but I have to say that throughout the book, New York obviously seems like the capital of jazz, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the Midwest plays a big role. In this, locally, we've got Bix Beiderbecke here is somebody locally that played a role. But talk about the role that the Midwest region played as a whole. It seemed like they were coming here quite a bit.
Yes. Well, jazz really, as I say in the book, it came about in New Orleans with this sort of clash of weather fronts, this meeting of New Orleans funeral music and African music. And Cuban music all coalesced within New Orleans, and then traveled up the Mississippi to Kansas City and St. Louis and Chicago, and all of those places, New Orleans and Kansas City and Chicago, were very important sources. And Detroit, by the way, and Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh isn't quite Midwestern, but all those places were very important seedbeds for jazz. And of course, many of the greats came. Yeah, Bix Beiderbecke, Charlie Parker came from Kansas City, Miles from St. Louis. So the Midwest was incredibly important to this music.
So this album is made 1959, and as you said, the three individuals go their own way. Then you've got the British invasion. And you talk about that. What happened there? That kind of it kind of forced jazz to improvise a little more, it seems like, to me anyway. But it didn't die off, but it did maybe take a different form. Talk about that part of it, musical history as well.
Sure. Well, listen, there was this night of Sunday night, February 9th, 1964. This is just barely 2.5 months after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And for those 2.5 months, America was sunk in dark gloom. And there suddenly on Sunday night, February 9th, 1964, a couple of months later, on the Ed Sullivan Show, you had these four young guys from Liverpool playing this infectious, beautiful, wonderful, enlivening music, and performing it so greatly that you suddenly had thousands upon that next morning, Monday morning, February 10th, thousands of primarily young white boys figuring they didn't have to kill themselves anymore practicing the trumpet or trying to learn the saxophone. They could go out and buy an electric guitar and be like the Beatles. In a very serious way, that night was a neutron bomb that dropped on jazz. Jazz never quite survived that collision. Rock and roll became so gigantic in the States and around the world, and with the Beatles for the next 5-6 years, that that jazz sort of contracted into this corner of the landscape. And that was happening at the same time as we were turning into a land of 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 different tribes, cultural tribes. And certainly rock and roll was a big one, but jazz became a smaller and smaller one over the years. It has, sadly, despite the fact there are many brilliant musicians playing today, jazz musicians, it's more of a niche art than it was back at the turn of the 1950s into the 60s.
Final question for James Kaplan. This is an unfair question, but I've got to ask it. If you had to pick one tune from Kind of Blue for our listeners to listen to, what would it be and why? And just, I got about 2 minutes here, Bob.
Right. So I'll be quick. No, that's not unfair at all. And in fact, it's an easy question to answer. But I just want to say quickly before I answer it, that this book of mine is really about joy. It's about my joy in this wonderful, dynamic, infectious music. And if there's anything that I can pass along to your listeners, I hope they'll understand how joyous this music can be. And I hope they'll find some joy in it themselves. The one tune I would pick from Kind of Blue is the first tune on the album, and it's called So What? It begins in this very quiet and mysterious way and then proceeds along. Miles plays one of the great solos in jazz history. His solo is actually one of the great melodies in history. The whole album, and in particular So What, is just a masterpiece of quiet, of restraint, of peace. It's a very peaceful album, and it's a timeless album. It's an album that really stands outside of that era or this era, any era, bears repeated listenings, and listen to So What. You can't do any better.
And So What, as I recall, you said was kind of a response to the times, all these events happening, and it's like, so what?
Yeah, well, that was Miles's ironic response to his times. Miles had a very wry sense of humor. And yes, So What was certainly his answer to the 50s and 60s.
James, it's been a pleasure in your passion and joy at this music and writing about it comes through very strongly in the book and in our interview. Three Shades of Blue, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Bill Evans, and The Lost Empire, Cool by James Kaplan. James, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been an absolute pleasure and delight to have you as a guest.
Robin, I love talking with you. I'd love to come back anytime. Thank you so much for having me today.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.